Like it was just the first few years were really simple and we were just trying to figure it all out. And then we were about two or change years in and somewhat out of the blue, we got a pretty meaningful offer to buy the business, right? Say $20, $30 million. And we had not thought of selling the business. We had not thought that was like that interesting of a thing to do or wasn't our plan. But then you just start running the numbers. And, you know, we were two or three years in, I was probably 27, 28. I was young. We're like, holy shit, we can make that kind of money. That's crazy. And then we were like, well, what? Instead of selling now, let's grow the business really fast for a really long time. And then we'll sell it for a huge, like, you know, like we kind of got dollar signs in our eyes. We got greedy.
Yeah.
And then we managed to grow the business by, you know, huge 100% a year for 3 years. And by the time we went out there, though, like our market, the ad tech market and the markets, like the market had just really cratered from like 3 years earlier.
In this episode, I'm talking to Jesse Pugge, the owner of Gateway X, a venture studio, and the former co-founder and executive chairman of Ampush, a performance marketing firm that he sold for eight figures in 2023. Before that, he was at Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, Wharton. Jesse's done it all. If you want to know anything about marketing, he is a massive resource, and we have some links to in the show notes to places where he goes deeper in marketing. And this one, we talk a lot about decision making, finding your own journey, going through the process of bootstrapping and deciding whether to bootstrap or raise venture money, and the importance of bootstrapping, which Jesse is a huge proponent of, and how to do that. And a quick reminder that this podcast, unlike every other podcast that you listen to, is not free. You owe me 5 stars, whether you like it or not. So go do that now, and we will get into the episode. You will love it. Peace. Jesse, what's up, dude? Thanks for coming on. I'm stoked to get into it.
Likewise, Riley. I've been following you and love what you talk about. So excited.
Yeah. So I've listened to a ton of your stuff, and hopefully I can talk about some things and we can kind of explore some things together that are maybe less talked about. And obviously I want to get into performance marketing and all of those things, but I found it interesting. what I say off air, and I think I'm going to actually do it more and more on air, is like what I say to the guys running some of my operating companies is like, I want to get you rich enough so you know that it's not the answer, but you need to get rich enough for you to know that it's not everything that you're looking for.
Freud, that Freud basically said he only took on wealthy or rich clients because they were the only people who wouldn't walk in, lie down on the couch and go, I need more money to make me happy. They're the only people who would say that. And so, but I also like the Kanye line on it too, right? Which is like, having money is not everything, but not having it is. Because I think a lot of times once you've made some money, like you sort of forget what that felt like. Not having it really is everything. Like, if that's what it feels for most people, at least.
My Kanye line that I use is like, what you think I rap for to push a fucking rap for, you know? like if you're doing it, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. And and so I thought it was interesting growing up. So my dad was a lawyer growing up. So that kind of like colored so much of my initial path of like what I thought I wanted to do going forward.
Right.
Obviously, your dad was immigrant, entrepreneur. And I know that colored a ton of your kind of initial thing of, you know, shoveling snow and driveways and doing all those things. As you kind of got to the adult stage, whatever, picking Wharton and kind of deciding the next path, what was the interpersonal side of that? Was he like, you should go get the best education possible? Or was he saying, go start selling stuff? How did it look?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, he was an entrepreneur, and that was a big model. The other funny thing is, like, he started investing in the bubble, the tech bubble, and so that was like an interesting. I think that's what piqued my interest in both tech and like finance, because I was like, what is the stock market and how does this all work? And so, you know, he definitely was like, go get a great education. Like, if you're South Asian, you know, Indian, like that is just education is always the number one thing.
Table stakes.
It's like optimize and be the best education you can get. And then, you know, when I worked on Wall Street, I was 25 when I worked at Goldman Sachs, and my boss was 29, and she was making $2 million a year. We were working like at a hedge fund. And then
it's crazy.
You know, to him, entrepreneurship wasn't a choice. It was a thing you did because you didn't really have another option.
Yeah.
And you'd grind it out as a small business owner, and you'd make a few a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And that was life. That was what you did. And so funny enough, like, he was not super supportive when I left Goldman to start a company, because in his mind, he's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, you're telling me in 4 or 5 years, you can be making the kind of money your boss was making? Like, why would you ever get off that train? That makes no sense. And it made no sense at all to him that I would get off that train. You know, a few years later, he's like, okay, I kind of get it. But, you know, obviously I wasn't a parent at the time. I'm a parent now. And now as a parent, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's kind of what, you just want what's best for your kid. And you're like, why would you risk all this trajectory, this track you've gotten to? And I went to start a business. I had no idea anything about it. Online advertising. Like, he's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why are you starting something? Go learn something and then start a business. And so, you know, again, in retrospect, I have a lot more empathy for his perspective. At the time, I was like, oh man, my dad doesn't support me doing this. Like, what the fuck? So
was that a big riff for me when I was quitting law to go and become an entrepreneur? He was a lawyer. I'd gone to the University of Chicago. I'd done everything right, and it looked like I was pacing correctly. And when I left to do my own thing, it was like a big riff in our relationship, like, for years. And it was probably me being slightly of a, you know, a victim of, like, my dad should support me doing what I love. Why don't you love me more? And what I'm,
my mom, the funny thing my mom said was like, where am I going to tell people you work now? Cause like, she was telling people I worked at Goldman Sachs. She loved that. Right. Which I feel now as a parent, but, it wasn't a big riff. My dad he would sort of say his piece, and he did a great job even from a pretty young age of giving us a lot of autonomy and sort of going like, I don't have to agree with all of your decisions, but I'm certainly going to say what I think. And so I don't think I looked at it as like a, you know, I moved in with them. I was 25. I went and lived at home to get Ambush off the ground because we were bootstrapping. And it wasn't like he was like, hey, you can't live here. He was like, no, like, you're on your path. You're figuring out what you're figuring out. But he was just like, the logic of it made no sense to him, which, again, in retrospect, I get that. But it wasn't something we kept. We didn't revisit it. We just like, all right, how's your business going? What are you doing? What's the latest? Once he had said it, it was sort of like we moved past it. And then I think after we had our first big win, 3 years in or so, he was like, he sent me and my co-founder, who obviously became close to my parents, he sent us an email being like, man, I thought you guys were crazy. I didn't know what you're doing, but like, great job. It didn't become a huge riff or anything like that.
No, that's amazing. I quit at 26. I only lasted at a law firm in New York and Dallas for 9 months. I quit to do an escape room business, and which was like basically in their mind, I was leaving to join the carnival or something, like a traveling fair, you know, like a P.T. Barnum. Like, they thought I was like in Cirque du Soleil or something.
And what year was that?
This is in 2016.
Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to think, because it's so funny. I, in 2012, maybe 2013, I went to Thailand. I went to Bangkok and, you know, just trip with my wife. And we get to Bangkok and we're looking on TripAdvisor, like, what are the top attractions? The number one attraction was this thing called an escape room.
Yeah.
And we were like, what is this thing? Like, and we just thought it was the like strangest. And then we just said, well, but it's the number one attraction. Like, let's go to it. And we went to it and we were like, this is amazing. Like, this is it. And so it's interesting. I mean, I remember being early to it, and I remember thinking to myself, like, that's going to be an interesting business for people. But we love escape rooms.
In Europe and Asia, it had gotten popular much sooner than the US. We found it off of TripAdvisor, and I actually got all of the room designs that we, because I didn't know puzzles or any of that stuff. I just did it because it was a great way to quit the law. I went to TripAdvisor and found like the best escape room in Estonia that had like 10,000 5-star reviews. And I like emailed them and I was like, can I buy your, like, can I license your room designs for the US? And they're like, sure. Like, if you send us $5,000, we'll like tell you everything. I'm like, that's amazing. Yeah. So like all of our original room designs were from Europe because they just progressed so much faster, you know, and the US that's was awesome. A laggard on that. It was interesting, at least in my path, knowing that I wanted to be a lawyer and then kind of shedding that to be an entrepreneur and doing something that was so looked down upon in prestigious circles, right? Like how you think about that, obviously,
Yeah.
Today.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I went from Goldman Sachs to like running online ads.
Right.
Performance marketing.
Yeah. And, marketers aren't
I do think there is a prestige. I mean, you know, those places have status and they have prestige and they have, and you know, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't on my mind a little bit. And I remember the arc and, you know, like this is, as you get old enough, you like, you realize it's just like life is different. You know, there's just different seasons and phases. But I remember initially, like my friends who stayed in finance were like associates and it was like, man, they're still like are these fancy jobs and I'm kind of doing this random thing. It feels so narrow relative to finance or law, which feel broad in their own ways.
Optionality.
Then,
I'm losing,
you know,
optionality.
2-3 years later, Ampush is printing cash. I mean, we're making, you know, millions of dollars in EBITDA. And these guys are, you know, senior associates. And I'm like, yeah, right. I'm the man, you know, like, this is great. I'm crushing it. And then you fast forward a few more years and it's like, okay, now Ampush is like plateauing and my, you know, I'm kind of bored. And my friends now are becoming VPs and managing directors and like, oh, they're buying a $1 billion business. And and then, you know, a few more years forward, like it just keeps, if you keep comparing yourself in those situations, it's never a healthy thing. And I think there was definitely, the way I kind of made peace with the decision, I think at some point was, I said, you know what, this is not, and this has been a philosophy of my life, you know, it's gotten larger over time, which is I'm not making the highest expected value decision. Like I remember when I left Goldman, I said, I got to be comfortable that my earnings are going to get cut more than half for my whole life. But I prefer to be an entrepreneur than to continue to work on Wall Street. And so, and I've made lots of decisions like that over time where I'm not expected value maximizing. I'm like joy, you know, or energy value maximizing.
It hasn't happened as much recently in the past, maybe couple years, but as I left that life, like the New York law firm life, is there ever a part of you that like when I watch Succession or like these totally fake shows and I see like the boardroom drama and like, you know, the New York City high rise and like I've run small businesses for 7-8 years. And obviously the equivalency of people that are still working at big law firms and, you know, experience those little high highs that you see at in Suits or Succession or whatever. There's always a part of me that's like, like, I wish that I could have that too. Like that looks dope, you know, to like do all those things that you don't really do on a super consistent basis running small, mid-sized businesses.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say exactly that. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure who would ever want to be the lawyer. No offense. Like lawyers, I mean.
No.
The second I got close to anything and I saw lawyers, or even in Succession, like lawyers, man, they're paper pushing. Like it's.
Totally. Have you seen Billions?
Sure, sure.
Have you seen and like so that would be the equivalent of your world, where like Goldman trader or whatever, doing all these things.
I think
like running
there's
a
part
desk.
Of me sometimes that thinks I could have, and I might still be, I should say, a finance oriented entrepreneur. Because I will say, like people who start private equity or hedge funds, they're still pretty entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's off the table in my mind personally. Like there's days where I wake up and I think like I should start a private equity firm, which you know I'm young enough that I could probably easily still do that. And so
totally.
I think there is ultimately there's a ton of leverage in capital and capital, you know, assets under management and 2 and 20. And especially if you have an edge, and we've been kicking around lately on this side, like stuff around customer acquisition and digital marketing, because most private equity, you know, people aren't underwriting it. They're just, they don't understand it all that well. So we started one business that's actually serving private equity firms. But in general, I think there's a lot of opportunities. Still
which one is that?
We haven't talked about it much publicly. It's called Ox Insights. And, you know, it came out of a need that we saw that was underserved where, you know, Bain and McKinsey have multi-billion-dollar private equity businesses where they just basically do due diligence, you know, the same way your house gets an inspection from someone before you buy it. McKinsey or Bain will come in and kick the tires on some specific issue of the business. Now, digital marketing, customer acquisition is a huge line item of investment for most, you know, for a lot of businesses, both B2C and B2B. And I would get a call from a friend from college once a month going like, hey, I'm about to buy this business for $500 million. Are they good at this, Jesse? Can you look at it? Can you tell me like, what are the levers? And I'd kind of have that reaction. I'd laugh and I'd say, well, here's 10 questions you should ask, but I don't have time to look at it. And then I got enough of the phone calls where I was like, well, hold on, you know, let me spin up a company around this. And so, you know, we will come in at a transaction level or right after transactions close or prior transaction taking place and basically come in and be, you know, the equivalent of a home inspector, but for digital marketing and customer acquisition, and maybe more than a home inspector, we'll actually tell them what we think strategically they can do from a levers perspective to grow the business and be able to realize the value of digital marketing.
I'm interested. So my my come up in marketing, which is very lackluster, is as I was running the trampoline parks, my wife started an Instagram business where she was selling meal plans through her Instagram. And it became this thing that was like, you know, it was a $45 thing. She was growing her following. She was making 50 or 60 grand a month doing it back when Instagram was really pushing a bunch of organic visibility. And so I watched this thing from Russell Brunson going to Grant Cardone's 10X thing about like marketing and click funnels and, you know, negative customer acquisition costs thing. I mean, I had taken a marketing class in undergrad and that was kind of the end of it. But as I was trying to help grow my wife's business at the time, and I saw Russell Brunson talk about marketing and click funnels and like the importance of marketing and growing a business, I got pretty deep into that world, digital marketing, direct response marketing. And it's been interesting, like a guy, one of my operators of a business that I own, Media Acquire, he was from the ClickFunnels world, this kind of like direct response world. And so I know that there's, I would say Russell is a brilliant marketer, but when I listen to Russell Brunson talk about marketing and funnels, and then when I've listened to you with O'Shaughnessy or whoever on kind of like, I would say a more finance-driven marketing approach, you know, kind of like you're talking about a finance-driven entrepreneur. I was interested to know, and this is a very clumsy question, of like where you see kind of like the direct response world of kind of the Russell Brunsons of the world versus what you did at Ampush and where they map and, you know, when's the right context to use either of them, or
I think they're sort of in violent agreement is my perspective. And as Facebook and Meta have evolved, they've gotten even more in violent agreement. Ultimately, there's the human side of this, right? You're showing some people or group of people a message and it's like, what do they do with it? Do they stop their thumb and look at it? Or do they, you know, they're searching for it. Are they the ad you choose? And then what do they do when they land on the page? Do they, you know, keep going? Do they get confused? Is it creating urgency for them? You know, and I'd say I think very much like if all I could do every week or day was create really well-written copy or amazing creative with all the principles, the psychological principles, like I would probably do that. Like, because, and you don't really need to look at those numbers. The best companies I've ever seen do marketing, they're so gifted at that, that they're not oftentimes like needing to be super quantitative and analytical, right? And I grew up on the side of being super quantitative and analytical. But I think where they get married is like, if you want to systematize that and turn it into a process and a machine, you need both of them. Like, that's kind of my perspective, right? So
yeah,
maybe here's a good analogy, which is if you're going to run one or two restaurants and you're a chef, man, you can walk in and you say you're an amazing chef. You're like, oh, here's a little paprika. And, you know, and no matter what you cook, it's delicious, right?
Right.
Because you're a great chef. And I think that's true for content creators and creative and certain companies that run creative. But if you then want to take that restaurant and you want to open the Vegas location and then the LA location, you want to scale it. You don't want to make it.
Right.
Well, then you got to get a little bit, you got to understand with some more rigor and precision what exactly is going on. How much paprika is getting put in? When is it? Is it in the first minute or the 10th minute?
Right.
And so my view has always been in using analytics and rigor. And like, I still think the game of the game is how do you, you know, creative ideas, crazy things, throw things against the wall, try stuff. But if you just do that by itself, then you get the thing that everybody talks about on Twitter, which is like, well, one day Meta loves me, one day they hate me. Like, everyone treats Meta like it's this volatile animal. And that's never been my experience with it. There's some volatility that's like you can understand, but then the reality is usually you're not generating enough creative. You're not measuring your hit rates. You're not thinking about what's going on in the auction and the algorithm. Like, and so I think they marry each other when you do both together, where you're building a lot of that creativity, those ideas, the messaging, the psychological principles, but then you're measuring everything and understanding how it plays into it. And you know, the thing I always tell people internally as well as other founders, I go, if your growth person can't give you the 1 month or the 90 day projection, they probably don't know what they're not, you're either your business is not mature enough or that person doesn't know what they're doing because they should be able to come up with it. Just like you would expect a salesperson to be able to tell you the forecast of their pipeline. Like, it's the same general idea. And so again, I think they marry each other. I think that they're both really important. And when they're together, they work really well. I think if you're just pushing numbers these days, that doesn't work at all. Well, it can, I guess, if you're doing it at a certain scale. But or if you're just being creative all the time, you end up in this really dangerous up and down cycle.
So So would you say, do you think it's a fair characterization? And again, this is my general interest, because like even in the escape room and trampoline park business, our marketing was our brick and mortar location. Like we honestly never really cracked like
right.
a digital, like if we wanted more sales, we would have people sign waivers. And so we would get their email and then we'd like push them right. like a discount code. It was like super
yeah,
unsophisticated. Yeah. And so like, it's almost been a disservice to me because I experienced success without ever totally. Having to build the skill of it.
I think it's that, or how do you scale that? Meaning how do you teach everyone to do the messaging, and how do you turn that into like a machine?
Right.
And that requires a lot of training and even first principles thinking sometimes that I don't think they bring. Like we, for example, there's this, you know, one of my favorite books. It's also one of Charlie Munger's favorite books, is called Influence by Robert Cialdini.
Mm-hmm.
And therein he talks about that. Have you read it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So like the book we read when I was running Ambush was, let's go read the actual source material on how the principles of influence work, because we wanted to bring our own spin to the copy or the creative or the systems. And like, I'll give you a good example, actually. So there's one of the principles is consistency. And this was one that most people don't understand all that well. Consistency is, there is like a irrational human desire to remain consistent with what you have said about yourself, right? So if I say that I am a good father, then when you're around, I want to make sure like I look like a good father, right?
Totally.
And there's so many cool stories in the book about how the Chinese turned American soldiers. Like, but one of the stories, examples he gives is the Conservation Society ran an experiment. They would call houses and say, hi, you know, this is Jesse. I'm calling. I'd love a $50-$100 donation. And, you know, I don't know, 2% of the people donated $50 on average, something like that. I don't remember the exact numbers. The second test was, they'd call you and they'd say, hey, Rally, are you someone who cares about our community? And you're like, well, yes, of course I am.
Of course, yeah.
And are you someone who cares about the environment? And yes, I am. I'm so glad you said that, because I'm calling from the Conservation Society today. And we're looking for a donation. And, you know, I think the conversion rate was 3 or 4 times and the average amount donated was like double or triple.
Yeah.
And that's a consistency principle, because the person, even in that moment, they irrationally stuck to the fact that they had said that they were those things already. And then they get it. So we were like, all right, how do we play around with that? And we had one of the big fresh dog food customers, one of the big Farmer's Dog, Ali, like those guys who were making great, high quality, health grade, human grade dog food. And so I was like, oh, let's play around with this. And we came up with a quiz called the Are You a Good Dog Owner quiz, or Do You Love Your Dog? And so we'd run this Facebook ad and we'd be like, do you love your dog, or are you a good dog owner? And the person would land and we'd say like, what's your dog's name? Type it in. You're like, oh, my dog's Bob. Okay. And is your dog part of the family? Yes or no? Yes. Do you love your dog? Yes or no? Do you care about your dog's health? Yes or no? And in 99.9% people said, yes, 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 yes. I said, we're so glad that you are a good dog owner, and you should feed your dog human grade good dog food. And the conversion rate, like the overall kind of funnel conversion went up by 70%. So like the CPA went down, 40 or 50%. And so I was always just more curious, like my version of it is just to get to the first principles of being a human and understand those things, and then from there build up capable marketing. But I think there's some truth to your 0 to 1 versus 1 to whatever, but there's also
sure.
just wanting to understand the first principles of it.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I've heard you talk a lot about the process of running Ambush, getting it to a place where you thought that it was maybe sell it, and going through a transaction process, being disappointed in that. For me, it was very disorienting when I was running this business that had helped me get out of the law and helped me kind of, it had right. given me my success. And just one day I, like my COO calls me and I'm just like, I don't really want to know what you have to say right now. I remember just being like, I think I'm done. Like I'm kind of out on this thing, but not knowing what the next thing was. Was there something similar for you running Ambush with partners, the
kind
market?
Of, yeah. I wish I had been more maybe intentional or deliberate, or really maybe the better way to say it is, I wish I had honored what I think I knew and felt already. And I don't think I did. And so, our story was, we started the business in 2010, didn't know anything about anything, got lucky in some sense, obviously worked hard, but like discovered Facebook ads and
right.
we're in the right place at the right time. And I'm a big fan of like, what I call sandbox entrepreneurship. You got to be in the sandbox, like we were not going to figure out Facebook advertising sitting at Goldman Sachs. We had to be doing something in the market to go figure it out and to see the opportunity. And so we saw it, we capitalized on it. And I think we were just like, wow, we're learning how to drive this business, like learning how to run a business, learning how to ride a bike. Like it was just the first few years were really simple and we were just trying to figure it all out. And then we were about two or change years in and somewhat out of the blue, we got a pretty meaningful offer to buy the business, right? Say $20, $30 million. And we had not thought of selling the business. We had not thought that was like that interesting of a thing to do or wasn't our plan. But then you just start running the numbers. And, you know, we were two or three years in, I was probably 27, 28. I was young. We're like, holy shit, we can make that kind of money. That's crazy. And then we're like, well, what? Instead of selling now, let's grow the business really fast for a really long time. And then we'll sell it for a huge, like, you know, like we kind of got dollar signs in our eyes. We got greedy.
Yeah.
And then we managed to grow the business by, you know, huge 100% a year for 3 years. And by the time we went out there, though, like our market, the ad tech market and the markets, like the market had just really cratered from like 3 years earlier. And so we got bigger offers that were, you know, multiples, two or three times the initial offer we got. But we had grinded ourselves. We were just dead. We were tired. Yeah. We knew we were tired. We wanted to sell the business. And that was our leading thing. We were like, we're going to sell this business now. Like, we're done. But we thought we were going to sell it for like $150 million. And the offers probably were half that, right? Which are still life-changing. It was bootstrapped. Like, but I was so disappointed in that moment. And I didn't even know what disappointment was. I didn't know what it felt like. But I was so disappointed. I was like, no, that they're wrong. Like in the market, you know, the learning as you know now and I know now is like the market's never wrong. Whatever it says, you can say no to it, obviously. You don't have to say yes to it. But whatever they're saying is what the business is worth in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think if I had trusted, if I had like felt my feelings and my disappointment around it, I would have made a more level-headed decision, which was probably at that point, we're done. Let's sell the business and let's like go join, you know, an acquirer and go through that sort of journey. Instead, we did a deal, which ended up being fine, but like we sold a minority interest in the company and we sort of signed up to this kind of strange deal. What we did is we gave the acquirer, we gave this business Red Ventures, we gave them a call option to buy the rest of the business at like a nominal price. So it wasn't an actual multiple. It wasn't a multiple though. It was just it was single year price. And the thinking behind that was it's 2 years long. So they have 2 years basically. It's basically, I called it like a reverse earnout. So what would happen is like, if it worked, they would have a lot of incentive to pump our business full of profits and EBITDA because they could buy it at a nominal price.
Right.
Right. So they don't care. We wanted them to have an incentive to invest in us, not be penalized for us improving.
Right.
And for us, we sort of had a number in our head and we're like, if you can hit the number, we're happy.
Right.
Right. And then if that doesn't work, then like instead of a normal earnout, right, which ends up happening, if an earnout doesn't work out, you just don't get any money and your business is gone and that's it. That's the end of the conversation. In this case, no, if it doesn't work out, we would retain our business. And so it was actually a really cool deal when you think of like the managing all the various like incentives and alignment and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But what it was missing was my emotional energy was done. I was tired.
Especially as you cash out, right? Did you cash?
Yeah, we took a little off the table, right? The 15 million was secondary, right? So
So
I took some cash off the table. My son was born that year. And then, you know, we got 6 to 12 months ago. Oh my gosh, we signed up to like, go do a whole new thing. You know, like, oh my, I'm tired. Like I have a newborn. I don't want to do this. Like, and so my moment was maybe in 16 or 17, like, or I just didn't even, like, I came into the office half a day, you know, for 6 months straight because I was so tired. And I was just like, why? I don't want to do this. Like, I really don't want to. And so in my case, I had signed up to do it, you know, and I talked to the founder and CEO of that company. And he was extremely gracious. And, you know, he gave me a lot of perspective in that moment. You know, he said, dude, you're one of the luckiest guys I know. You're 32 or 33, two beautiful children. You've done really well. You know, you run your own show, you make your own calls. And he sort of said, like, stop acting like your business owns you, act like you own it. So make it whatever you want it to be for yourself. And if that means that you just want to grow and learn, great. If you want to go get a coach and have them like, and he also was like pushing me nicely. He was like, do some inner work because you clearly been really successful and really lucky and you're somehow feeling bad for yourself. Like, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, like he literally said that, like after I gave my little whining story to him, he was like, dude, Jesse, you are one of the luckiest motherfuckers I know. That's literally what he said to me. And the fact that you're not seeing that, like, you got to go do some work. And so that's the point. For me, that was a big turning point because I went and hired a coach. And then the coach just sort of blew my mind. Like, there was all these things that I like, lack of self-awareness, things I just didn't know about myself in the moment. Yeah. I didn't understand emotions very well. Like, I would not have guessed prior to working with a coach that I was like so stupid and ignorant on these things. My wife would have. She's like, dude, you didn't know anything. What's wrong with you? But like, but I didn't. And then like, it started this really cool journey where I was like really like peeling the onion of Jesse,
right?
Which was not always pretty and whatever, but it was a really, really, and the journey I continued to be on.
I think two interesting things there. One, it's fortuitous to have a partner, particularly minority partner or a financial partner. You know, Red Venture is a big place that can hear you wanting to do something else and them and giving you good advice in that space. Like I've heard, totally. I've seen, I've experienced, right, where a partner is like, I think I'm out, right? It's like an acceleration clause that it leads to doomsday. Like you're trying to avoid doomsday, and in trying to avoid it, you create it. So I just think that's awesome of them. Not all private equity firms act like that. You know, when someone's saying, hey, I'm out.
I think it's huge. And trust, I think trust is so underrated as just a core operating component. Because there could have been trust that I would, if I didn't share that with him. You know, he doesn't really know what's going on. Like, he's invested in us. Like, and then the trust in him to know that he's not going to react and be like, well, like, you're fired. You know, like, he couldn't have technically fired me, but like, you know, any investor can put a lot of pressure to go, well,
you can make it super uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. And neither of those two things happen, you know, but that's a trusted relationship. And there's a lot of lessons for how I run and partner with a lot of the CEOs at Gateway X, which is like, yeah, you can tell me anything. And a lot of people say that, but then someone says something and then it's clear that that's actually not the case. Yeah. You can tell me anything except for this. Like, no, you can actually tell me anything. And all I'm going to do a lot of times is listen, you know, make sure you feel heard and be there for what you're thinking and feeling. And, you know, if you pick the right people and you work with the right people, like, they generally also want to get to the place where they can solve it or perform well or do well. And like, they don't need you to do that in that moment. They want someone to trust. And to feel totally. Heard. And so, you know, you have to have people treat you like that to know that that's possible and then treat other people like that.
Do you feel like there was a part of you, and again, this is me in my own story. And for me, it was even harder. It took my wife getting cancer and I had a friend refer a coach and I got on the phone with the coach and I'm like, I'm good, but my wife needs coaching. And they're like, okay, well, like, let's go into that for like an hour. And like 45 minutes later, I'm like, I'm like crying. Like, why wasn't I hugged? You know, like for me, if you had asked me, it required money and cancer for me. Because before that, it would have just been like, I'll be good once I need an extra zero in the bank account. And then like, that's my real problem. All this other stuff will sort itself out. Today's episode is brought to you by the Exit Operating System. If you run a business right now and you are thinking about selling it one day and you want to know what you should focus on in order to maximize your exit value, go to exitos.io and sign up now. Peace.
Yeah. 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 I mean, look, I'm sort of torn, right? Because I always tell people like, man, if you can get coaching sooner, like you don't need that money or whatever. Like you can focus on, I tweeted, you probably saw it the other day where I said, look, like this great paradox, like everybody wants to just be happy and fulfilled and content. And then we sort of go, well, the thing that will get me that is money, which is the biggest lie everybody tells themselves. And then, oh, in order to get money, I can't be content. I got to grind and I got to have my edge.
Yeah.
And then you get money and then you're like, wait, I'm not that happy with this. And I got to grind it. Like, that's who I am. I'm a grinder. So there's part of me that goes, yeah, try exploring early. And don't, you know, get on the coaching and self-development thing earlier than you can. And then, you know, what most coaches say is like, look, everyone's on their journey and you raise your hand when you raise your hand. And, you know, some people it's when your wife has cancer. Some people it's when you sort of have a partial exit and you don't know what you're doing. Like Rick, the founder of Red Ventures, he was on the Sully plane that landed in the Hudson and he basically thought he was going to die for 10 minutes. And that was his wake up call. And so everyone's got their own, you know, that's what any coach will tell you is like, everyone is on their own journey and you can't force someone to start it, you know, sooner or later. And the thing I'm torn a little bit about is like, I would be lying to someone if I told them that like having a few million dollars in my bank account when I was 30 or 31 wasn't, and the year my son was born was not didn't feel really good and didn't feel really satisfying and happy. And like that was an important part for me. It did help. It did actually help. Right. And so I don't want to lie to someone. I wish I didn't have that, but that was the truth. I had it and it mattered.
I want to talk about the importance of bootstrapping to you, it was a process. It was what I did as well. I enjoyed what you said about bootstrapping as like viewing your customers as investors. I think it's very easy when you're operating a business and you hear customer complaints and customer frustrations, and you kind of start building this like acrimonious relationship with your customers. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, yeah. Like kind of like, fuck you guys. Like you just don't get it. And versus investors, you're like, at least I, with the investors that I took, I was always like very like, you know, mindful of my P&Qs and like making sure that they're happy. And like, you know, it's my responsibility. You gave me your capital, fiduciary duty, all this stuff. Talk a little bit about bootstrapping as opposed to venture capital, and keeping that eye towards, you know, that relationship with customers and maintaining.
In my experience, you know, look, I think the, just to be extreme for a second, the people who end up kind of may having acrimonious relationships with their clients also end up having acrimonious relationships with their investors, also having acrimonious relationships with their wife. Just to be extreme, right? Like,
they're just it's acrimonious.
Well, it's not that. It's like those are typically people who feel like the world's out to get them, that they're, right, you know, the victim.
Victims.
And we all have our victim moments. I have them every day, right? But I think there is a thing around how do you treat other people, which everyone's just a person at the end of the day, whether they're your client or investor or your stakeholder. I think really focusing on how you treat people and whether you're willing to kind of step up to the plate and take responsibility for various situations, I think is just a super important thing for every developing entrepreneur, especially younger entrepreneurs, because it's really easy to get yourself into this mode of like, everyone's against me and I'm the victim and I need a different part of that. Yeah. I think for us bootstrapping, I was and continue to be somewhat obsessed with the value of cash flow. You know, there was a saying I used to have at Ampush, which was, if we could make a dollar a month in profit, our runway is infinite.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We never have to go out of business, and then we can grow and we can learn and we can do all these other things, right? Our $1 in profit and our runway is infinite. And I just love that idea. Like, I love the idea that I wasn't dependent on outside people to make something happen. Or like, I think the other story I appended to venture capital, which is not necessarily true, but at the time, that's how I thought about it, was like, you have a good idea, you raise some money, you run really hard while you burn that money, and then it either works or it doesn't work. That was sort of the story I told myself, right? And I was like, I don't want that. I want something that's like, I can like compound and get better. And, you know, and so if I force myself to make a profit early, then I'll always have another day. I always have another at bat. And I liked the idea of having sort of this infinite runway, I guess, to call it.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is like, I, you know, coming from my investor sort of mindset and working at Goldman, like, I love compounding, both the power of compounding learnings, compounding capital. And so I was always thinking of ways to compound what you're doing. And obviously inbound cash flow is a great way to compound anything. And so that was another thing that attracted me to it. So
yeah,
there's a lot of pieces to it. But that's generally how I thought about it.
How do you think about cutting versus keeping, right? You have resources now. If you're bootstrapping, you could continue to fund a losing bet for a while, right? And self-fund it. It's really hard to call the game an L, especially if you get some Midas touch. I've won. I can do this. I've done this before. Right. How do you think about cutting a loser and versus like, oh, we just need more at bats to turn this thing around? Do you put stop limits in? Sure. How do you think about it?
I think I've kind of come to stop limits over time. I mean, I think I'm an optimist. Of like blue hearted, red hearted, whatever the hell optimist. Like, I always believe, and I do have quite a Midas touch. Like, I do have the ability to find the one person who can buy the thing we're selling, and it's really dangerous, actually. Because I can keep things, bad ideas alive for a long time. And so I think part of it is setting up reasonably good, like high goal. I think the other connecting piece is like raising the bar on yourself, challenging yourself, trying to build a big enough pipeline of people. Like, a good example is like, if you put a job rec out, and let's say you only put it out in the like 1 mile radius of your office, like, do you think you're going to get the best person? Yeah. No. If you put it in your whole city, you're likely to get it. If you put it in the whole country, you're likely to get it. And it's just like the size of your pipeline determines how good you're going to find something. And so the same thing happens with ideas, with like willingness to try different things. So I think you also have to have a lot going and enough going so that you can see what great looks like. But yeah, I think the best thing, honestly, is, you know, and also learned it from the Red Ventures guys, is like, at some point after a certain period of time, call it 6 to 9 months, it just doesn't matter why it's not working.
Right.
Like you stop trying to guess, stop trying to think about the other variable. Like, yes, for a period of time, you want to be fully in it. And then if it's not getting, you're not seeing that trajectory, you're not seeing a certain nominal place you've gotten to, just kill it.
Yeah.
Right. And the funny thing is, like, we do this in content or we do this in ads all the time. Like, it's like 2 times the CPA. And that's what I've always done. It's like, well, if I've spent 2 times the CPA on a single ad and it hasn't generated any purchases, like, kill it. Does that mean it's never going to work in the future? No, it doesn't. It might, but like, I'm just going to kill it for the sake of killing it for now so I can try other things. And I think the same general thing with ideas, which is like, again, 6 to 12 months, maybe if it's not hitting the things you think, because you can lie to yourself for a really long time if you don't do that. And I've done that.
You can burn a lot of your own money.
You can burn yourself on a person who's probably not going to work out.
Yeah.
Like there's just so many places it can show up.
One of the best books I read was a book called Necessary Endings, which is like a relationship book, but it kind of talks about like a rose bush. Rose bushes have to be trimmed in order to maintain, like every additional limb keeps energy and takes energy from the main thing. And so like you have to think of it in terms of like either you need new focus to dedicate or you need new resources to dedicate. And if you're not willing to do either of those things, I mean, this podcast, Deal Maven, I originally started Deal Maven to try to be like a micro acquire software platform for partial acquisitions. I was like, I was like, I did brick and mortar. I'm going to do software because like I can do anything. Right. And like 9 months in, a couple hundred grand in, I'm like, I freaking hate software. Like this is atrocious. I hate the developers. I hate all of it. Yeah. And I was like, oh, maybe. And I've gone through similar things, right? Where it's like, maybe it's a media thing. Maybe it's a more content based thing. And continuing to pivot around because it's such an ego hit.
Underlying that, you know, there's an important lesson, I think, which is learning, like getting to know yourself. And, you know, there are some entrepreneurs, like I've had periods where I've burned money or for various businesses, like I don't like it. It makes me feel icky. Like I just don't have the ability. If someone gives me money and I don't have a plan to how I'm going to get it back to them, a minimum, you know, dollar for dollar, but if ideally a return, and I'm burning money every day, like it just isn't, I just don't enjoy it. And I think honoring yourself, honoring your energy, what things get you excited versus what you should do or what the really smart idea is on the spreadsheet,
right,
I think is a really, really important part of growth for any business person, any entrepreneur, or really anybody, but in the context of entrepreneur, like I think it's an important moment.
Yeah, I think something similar happened to me with like I had marketers and they're like, you should do like coaching. It's like just like 100% gross profit. And then as I got into the details with people doing acquisitions, dispositions, I'm like, I freaking hate this. This is horrible.
Yeah.
One of the things I actually commented on this tweet that you had because I feel something similar, and so I'm interested to know if you have additional thoughts on this. It was basically the tweet on enjoying making the money much more than enjoying spending the money. And spending, you know, we spend a lot of time continuing to work far past like the point of diminishing returns, right?
Sure,
and like marginal utility reasons. What do you think about that?
It's a tough one, man. There's a book called Die with Zero, which I read this year and was really helpful. And, you know, it's obviously a provocative title, but it's actually a very rigorous, thoughtful book written by like a trader who talks about, you know, the formula of like earn as much money as you can, work your ass off, and then sell it or whatever, make your money and then give it to your kids and your dad. And like, he's just like, it makes no sense. Like, it's very lazy, actually, instead of thinking about like, well, when I'm 40, I can do a certain set of things that I won't be able to do when I'm 60. And so how do I get the maximized value out of that, you know, at different phases of your life? How do you plan that stuff? And if you're going to give your kids, like, you know, if your kid's starting a startup and you have the money, like that investing in them early is going to be really formative for them, right?
Yeah.
Versus like giving them the money when you're dead, when they may already have been successful.
65.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think that's a direction. I think depends on how deep you want to go, but like there's a scarcity thing here.
Yeah.
Where we feel like we're not enough, or we feel like we don't have enough, and that we may lose something. And it's very common. I have it. A lot of people have it. And so it's funny, when we fully sold Ampush was earlier this year, and I made a lot more money than I ever expected to make. And I remember the first feeling I had was scarcity.
Yeah.
It was, oh my God, what if I, you know, like I can't get the numbers here. What if it goes down? Like, I can't have that. And then I went, Nick, to your point, I bought myself a really nice car just so that I could do that and be like, yeah, I spent way more money on a car than makes any logical sense, but it's still here. We're still good. Like, I'm, you know, and I think it was almost like retraining the neural pathways to feel good about that and that I'll be fine. And then like something happened, actually literally within a month, and I got double the amount of money that the car cost that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Like a dividend from this business that I invested in. And it's like, that's like, you know, this kind of abundance versus scarcity orientation. But yeah, man, it's a struggle. Like it's like, I don't like designer stuff. Like in some days I'm like, man, I wish I did. Like, I wish I did like some of that stuff, because it'd be fun to like, you know, like you see, and it's just not how I feel about it. And part of it, that's okay. But part of it is like, where am I coming from with it? If I genuinely just don't care and don't like it, who cares? But if I'm like, limiting myself in some way when I don't have to, just because of some belief I have, that seems really stupid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, some of it is also just sorting it out. I think like, I was in Turkey a month ago traveling, and had a really great experience at a really nice hotel at a Mandarin Oriental. And like, we were really expensive. It's something I normally would never have done. And I was telling my wife, I'm like, you know, it's interesting. Like, this feels like we paid 2 times the price of what we would probably normally have paid, but we got 5 times the like service value. Yeah. And we liked it. We liked the fact that people were around us. So like, okay, maybe travel is a place where we'll splurge. Like, I don't care if, I don't know what this was, like Banana Republic, or like, you know, I don't care if it's a Louis Vuitton, like, it's not going to be 10 times more valuable to me, right? So it's okay to pick the places. And I think some of that's just a learning process that you go through. But it is definitely like one of these things where I'm like, man, every time I have to spend some money, I feel like I don't feel good about it. And that seems really stupid. Like, you know, I wish I felt fine about it.
I've had to do more like with coaching around like feeling guilty around pleasure and relaxing. I'm like, I'll relax.
Yeah.
Like if I go to a beach, I'm going to like do an outline for a book. Like I'm going to write.
Totally. Okay. That really resonates. It used to be a thing like, in the mornings for me and stuff. Like I know as soon as I wake up, I got to look at my phone. I got to get going. This should do like, and I would do it to people around me too, which was probably really annoying.
Totally.
And then just it's learning.
And for me, it feels, okay. it tends to be like when my wife goes out of town and the kids go out of town, like they're out of town right now, or we're recording this. And I'm like, I can go to the movies tonight. You know, I could I could relax. I don't have the guilt whenever the responsibility is. And so it's like, you think that the dollars will solve it. And I think, you know, it sometimes requires making the dollars to figure it out, but it's a paradox. Yeah. My last question for you, since we're on time, what is the book that you most frequently read, and where can people connect with you?
Yeah, there's a few books. The number one book I probably give out, and I probably should get it here in my new St. Louis office, is 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. And it was just a really transformative book for me. I think it's there's a bunch of resources on their website. Like, it's just a really, really powerful paradigm. And it's almost feels religious at times when you're reading it, because it feels very similar. Like, the themes are very similar.
Yeah,
that's number one. One for any aspiring entrepreneurs, I love the book by Matt Mulcahy, The Great CEO Within. And that's another one that I highly recommend to any aspiring CEO, founder, entrepreneurs. I usually keep it on my desk because it's like a reference guide. Like, oh, I need to have a hard conversation. How do you do that? I need to give someone feedback. I need to set up a new meeting that we don't run right now. Like, I find it to be a really, really helpful tactical guide. And then this is a new one for me, but like, I really enjoyed Traction and the EOS process, which is not something I was very familiar with. I sort of thought was like a small business thing. And I, you know, it's definitely written for small businesses, but I think it has a lot of lessons I can apply for high growth and startup-y type businesses.
Yeah. Where's the best place to connect? Gateway.
Probably still Twitter, although my DMs are just JS Pooji on Twitter is probably the best place.
All right, dude. Thanks for the time.